Dark Wraith Publishing presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 3 for Spring Semester 2013. Lecture 16, delivered on March 21, 2013. The title of this lecture is Cost of Capital and Its Components.
Today, the cost of capital and its components. This is the first of two lectures that will culminate in the one next Tuesday, where we will do an MCC iOS graph. If you don't know what that is, trust me, you don't want to until you have to see it. We'll do it together in class as a happy family. I'll be handing around sheets, and you'll work in teams, and you'll get the answers. And then once you have those answers, there will be an online quiz where you write the answers in from the work that's done in class. That way I can run around, and when you make a mistake, I can actually see it, and I can hit you on the head like this. No, not that. Just to make sure that you get it, because I promise you it will be on the exam, too. And if you master it here, you'll find that it's not as bad as it looks when you first do it. And it does look kind of obtuse when you first do it. First things first here. I'm going to give you, I thought about asking this, but I don't think I will. Let me give you the different ways that you could bring money into a company. Oh, God. Matter of fact, why don't I ask you, woman, what is one way that a company could bring money in? Say that again. Issue stock and bring money in through the issuance of stock. Okay. So we'll put that one down here. Really? There. Okay. And we would call that funds externally generated equity. Externally generated equity. That, in other words, we're going to sell ownership units to outside investors. Another way that it could happen. What would be another way that we could bring money into a company? Madam? Sales. Whoa, there's a radical one. Yeah, we could actually sell the product. Lord knows. Well, obviously we would have to, we'd sell the product and then we'd have to satisfy liabilities, and that residual would be the claim that the owners have. They could either get it as dividends or through plowback to grow the company. But we call that a really sucky marker. You know, no, internally generated equity. Now notice that these are actually both equity. One is we're earning money that the shareholders can claim, or we are selling new units of ownership. I should point out here that there are actually two ways that you can sell stock. There are two different kinds of stock. Well, actually, they're kind of like maybe more than that. But the two are common stock, and there's also this preferred stock, too. Preferred stock and common stock. Now, see if you remember anything from the dark days of the first half of this course. Do you remember which one is a safer investment? If you were wanting, you wanted ownership, but you didn't want it to be all that risky, which one would you go for?
Common.
No, you'd go for the preferred, because the preferred has to have its dividend paid first before the common. And the dividend is declared in the issue. You will be paid this much based upon the par value. So preferred is less risky than common. So you would anticipate that we're talking about the cost of capital. The lower the risk, the lower the expected return. This preferred would probably be a lower cost of capital type of thing than the common would. That's why you'll see companies, even though there are some downsides to preferred, you're stuck with it forever, paying this dividend all the time. Companies would go for it because it is a lower cost of capital. Well, we'll get that in a minute. Now, there's one other way that a company can actually bring money in. You know what? Before I hurt something I care about. Okay. One other way. You know what it is? Any guess? Not a clue? Yeah. Debt. Oh, I knew that. You know. Yeah, debt. You can actually borrow money. And I'm putting that one at the top because debt is actually the cheapest one of all for two reasons. One is it has to be paid first. Remember, the liability holders have the prior claim to cash flow and the equity owners have the residual claim. Debt is cheaper because these debt people have to be paid first. And if you don't pay them, stockholders, you don't pay them a dividend, bitch, but that's all they can do. You don't pay the debt holders. You remember what I told you. They'll shoot your dog, sell your Bible on Craigslist, and make your mother wear furry costumes that please them. You don't want to mess with the debt holders. So the cost of that capital will be the lower than the cost of equity. Because these cats have to be paid off first, so their position is safer. Lower risk, lower expected return. So here are the component costs of capital. The components of capital. Now let's get down to the cost. I'm going to give it to you, first of all, the simple way, and then a little bit more complicated. But here's the other reason debt is expensive. If I called this the cost of debt, case of D, think of it like the coupon. 5.8% coupon on a 30-year bond, well, that would be the cost of it. Wait. No. Case of D. No, I stuffed down two bags of potato chips before I came in here. I should not have done that. Because right now, I am just roaring from about the esophagus down to some yard parts. Okay. Wait a minute. That's nasty stuff. Nope. Not nearly enough, Jack. Oh, there we go. It's at the bottom. Sweet. Okay. See, one of the things about debt in a corporation is that if you remember those financial statements, the interest payment is considered an expense. So when you make that interest payment, that basically means that you're getting a tax shield on that debt. Because basically the interest is tax deductible on the debt. It's taken away before you calculate your taxes. So that means that what we really care about is not the cost of debt, case of D, but the after-tax cost of debt, case of AT, KAT sub D. The way you figure that out is you don't pay case of D for the debt, you don't pay the coupon, literally, because part of that is tax deductible. The coupon, really what you pay is 1 minus your tax rate times the cost of debt. 1 minus the tax rate times the cost of debt. That makes debt really cheap, comparatively speaking. I'm going to go through a couple of points on this right now. See if this... Yeah, there we go. Case of D, that's the cost of debt. Just what you pay the, you know, you say 5.8% coupon, there's your cost of debt. The AT, and I let me write that a little better there for you. K after tax cost of debt is equal to 1 minus the corporation's tax rate times what you actually see them pay. So if a company borrows money at, let's say from a bank at 10%, that's not really at the end of the day what they pay, because they'll deduct that 10% interest off their taxes. So really what they pay as far as a cost goes is just 1 minus the tax rate times it. You follow the idea there? So here's the problem. Let me lay this one out, because I'll figure out a way to ask you this a couple of different times on quizzes and tests. We have a progressive tax system, not just with personal, but also with corporate taxes. So the higher your net income, or the higher the earnings before taxes, the EBT, the higher your marginal tax bracket is, as a person and as a corporation. So, in other words, suppose that you had two companies, one that had a tax bracket of, let's say, 25%, and another one that had a tax bracket of, let's say, 34%. Now, each of them would go to the bank and say, I should like to borrow money. And let's say the bank charges them 10% APR on their money, to lend them money. Mega corporation here, its after-tax cost of debt would be 1 minus 0.34 times 10%. So mega corporation with a high marginal tax bracket pays actually 6.6% after taxes on its debt. Its cost of debt component, capital, is 6.6%. Another corporation going to the same bank getting the same interest rate, its after-tax cost of debt is 1 minus 0.25 times 10%. So that corporation, the smaller one, ends up paying after taxes 7.5% on the debt. That sucks. And I'll tell you right now, as a small business owner, these large corporations are getting a tax break. That's the way it works, according to our tax code. They actually are able to lower their taxes by debt more than I am. That can cause a lot of difficulties. Hang on here, I gotta kill this before it rings on me. You follow the problem? Now, this doesn't apply just at the corporate level. It's also at the personal level. Think about this. When you buy a home and you get a mortgage on it, your mortgage interest is tax deductible. It's a debt and it's tax deductible. So you've got a rich couple in a very high marginal tax bracket, borrows $200,000, and a poor couple in a low tax bracket borrows $200,000. Well, guess who actually pays less in interest? Because the mortgage interest is tax deductible, the wealthy couple actually will get a better deal than the poorer couple will. That's just the reality of our tax system, is that ownership of homes is differentially skewed towards the wealthy. A low-income couple says, well, I want to get a home and I'll borrow on it. I would tell them, you're out of your mind. Your tax bracket is really not going to make it advantageous for you to borrow to buy a home. Certainly not as much so as a wealthier couple in a high marginal tax bracket. Because, you see, they get a much larger deduction for their interest. Suppose that on interest on a loan, two couples, the poor couple and the rich couple, the poor couple has a tax bracket of, let's say, 15%. The rich couple has a tax bracket of 31%. Let's say that they both pay $10,000 in interest the first year of the mortgage. Well, on their taxes, they get to take this off, that $10,000. So the real after-tax, the after-tax mortgage interest that the poor couple pays is $10,000 times 1 minus 0.15. So they pay $8,500 after taxes. The rich couple, deducting that same $10,000 in their higher marginal tax bracket, spank me Jesus. Look at that. Oops, 6,900. That's a whopping difference. And especially when you're talking about a couple making a low amount of money. You see, it's actually our tax system is skewed so that you poor people shouldn't be buying houses because they just are not realizing any tax advantage compared to the risk of price volatility in the housing market. Not a good idea. But getting back to the corporations, again, the same phenomenon is happening. Big, huge, massive corporations that generate massive earnings before taxes, they're deducting interest, and so their tax shield on interest is large compared to the small company that would borrow. So in other words, the idea here is that a small company, just rationally, you're going to, in a case like mine, it would be more, I'm not really going to get much of a benefit out of borrowing, which means that I would actually be smarter to sell stock. But the problem is that debt is a cheaper source of capital than equity is, so I am actually being forced to construct a more risky corporation when I am a small corporation, and the debt, which is not as risky, encourages the big corporations to move their capital structure towards debt, which is less risky. So the tax structure sort of causes me to move towards more risk in my capital structure. Enough of that. Here's the deal. Typical corporation, it can use debt, it can use internally generated equity, or it can use externally generated equity. Externally generated equity. Quick little scenario here. Debt is cheapest source of capital. It's the cheapest because, first of all, debt is safer, so the investors won't want as much of a return for it. It's safer because the company has to pay its debt before it can pay equity payments. And also because of that tax shield. Those two working together make debt a very attractive source of capital. So here was the question that was asked, and it was an academic question. The two who asked it, Modigliani and Miller, they knew it wasn't realistic, the scenario. But they said, well, why isn't this what we see? If debt is cheaper than equity, why would we not see companies that were just pure debt? Why do we see companies that have stock? If stock is more expensive than debt to raise money, why would we ever see a company sell stock to finance its operations? It's so expensive, and it is expensive. Compared to debt, it can be knockdown expensive. Why would we ever see that? This was the question that was posed by the academics. Well, obviously, we see stock companies, so there's got to be a reason. And so that stimulated a discussion many, many years ago, and we came to understand it works like this. Look, the more debt you use in your capital structure, the cheaper your capital, your source of capital is. But the problem is, though, that as you borrow more money, you are going to get closer and closer to a times interest earned of one. In other words, as you borrow more money, you've got to pay more back, and you've got to pay more interest. Even if it's cheap interest, you're going to have more and more interest to pay, and so your EBIT is going to be under more and more pressure. Because, you know, if you got an EBIT of, let's say, $25,000 and you got $1,000 in interest payments, you got a times interest earned of 25-1. But if you ramp up your debt, yeah, it's cheap. Let's just borrow some more money and get rid of stock. Well, you ramp it up to $5,000 on the same $25,000. Oh, dear. A little bit sweatier. Your times interest earned has gone down to 25-5, which is 5-1. Oh, we're still okay. Let's borrow more money and get rid of stock. So we go ramp it up to, let's say, $10,000. We borrow so much money, we've got $10,000 in interest payments. Now you're at a 25-10 or 2.5 times interest earned. You see how you're getting closer and closer to that dead zone at 1? And this $25,000 is subject to volatility. We don't know if we're going to have $25,000 or $30,000 or $15,000. So the closer your interest gets to the mean, the expected value, the more likely it is that you could get into a scenario where you don't have enough money to pay, and that's the end of your company. What that means, and this is where the real world comes in, and I can speak to this rather clearly right now, is that basically lenders don't say, here's your interest rate, 10%. They'll say, all right, for the first $1 million you want to borrow, 10%. You want to borrow another $1 million, 12%. You want to buy another borrow another $1 million, 18%. The real world works with the debt cost going up because the banks and the other lenders, lenders say you're getting riskier. The more you borrow, the higher the probability is that you could end up in a default situation. So as you borrow more, your cost of debt capital will go up. What that means, and I can actually attest to this, not with my current corporation, but I had a company, the first time I actually ever saw this in the real world, I was consulting for a company, and we had done the plan for about $500,000 in borrowing. The bank, it was going to work like this. We wanted a line of credit up to $500,000. Not that we were going to use that much to build the inventory for it, but we wanted it up that. The bank laid it out like this. $200,000 was 12%, 12.2%, something like that. Okay, you go above that, up to your limit, then your interest we're going to charge you is 18.95%. So you really did see banks do this. They sure do. They say, up to this, we'll charge you this much in interest. Up above that, you're starting to scare us, more risk for us that you'll default, so we're going to charge you a higher interest rate. What that means then was that the original Modigliani-Miller proposition was this. Okay, if we've got a graph where this is the cost of capital, that is, in other words, the weighted of all the different components, And this is the percent of debt in the capital structure of the company. If we have zero debt in the capital structure, then the overall cost of capital will be just the cost of equity. You know, we don't have any debt, so it's just obviously going to be the cost of equity. As you borrow more, as you start to borrow, the cost of debt weighs in. The original idea was, okay, obviously, if you have gotten to 100% debt, then your cost of capital would be K after taxes D. So in other words, it seems like it should be just a straight downward line. The more debt, the lower your overall cost of capital. But we know that that's not the case, because realistically what happens is when you first start to borrow money, when you first start to borrow money, yeah, it does work like that. The cost of debt is cheaper than the cost of equity. But at some point, you start borrowing too much money, and that cost of debt starts to get bad, there's a point where probably before 100%, you're borrowing on debt, rather financing with pure debt, is going to end up costing more than if you would just finance some with equity. So, this is what we call the weighted average cost of capital curve, WACC, weighted average cost of capital. As you borrow money at first, you drop your weighted average cost of capital. However, there comes a point where the banks say, you're borrowing too much. We're going to start charging you out the butt for your borrowings. And it gets to the point where suddenly you start to swing upward, and eventually you've got so much debt, you're going to end up paying more than if you'd had some debt and some equity. See this little point here? That bottoming out point, we have a name for it. It's called the optimal capital structure. The optimal capital structure. Now here's the thing, and this is just research has shown this. You can see these optimal capital structures that behave, these WACCs. You'll see one company or one industry where they will be going down almost clear to 100%. So their optimal capital structure would be a lot of debt and a little bit of equity. We see this. Then there are other corporations we see where borrowing starts you out, but very quickly the banks start charging more for these kinds of corporations, and so their optimal capital structure actually doesn't have much debt in it at all. It turns out that the banks start charging out the butt for debt when the company's got 20-25% debt and 75% equity. And then you see a lot of companies are somewhere in the middle. It's not always perfectly 50-50, but it's usually somewhere in that area. Some companies bottom out a little below 50%. Some companies bottom out above 50%. It's all over the board. And there are some things that you know about. Here's the upshot, though. Companies, once they have calculated, and there's some mathematics that's done with it in higher courses I teach about it, but companies bust their butts to hold that optimal capital structure. If it begins to drift too far one way or the other, away from what they have figured out is their optimal capital structure, they will tear their butts to get it back online. Sometimes a company, literally, and you'll see this in SEC filings, the company says, we're selling stock because we are off our optimal capital structure. We've got too much debt, so we've got to bring it back down. we're out here, so we're going to sell a bunch of stock to rebalance the percent of stock to the percent of debt. They just say it right there. We don't really need the money as much as we actually just are doing it so that we can get ourselves back to our bottom, our lowest weighted average cost of capital. Then you'll see some companies go the other way. We've got too much equity. We made too much money internally. We sold stock, and now we're on the wrong side of this. We're up here with only a little bit of debt compared to our equity in our company. So we're just going to borrow money, issue bonds, just to get ourselves back down here to this low point. You can literally make so much money that you have to borrow to actually bring down your cost of capital. And that's something that goes to what we talk about with wealth, with financial management for people, especially rich people. You get these people who say, well, I don't want to borrow no money. I'll put everything down out of my pocket, out of my equity. And sometimes you can explain it, sometimes you can't. You say, you know what? You're financing everything you have with your equity in your lives. You're nuts. That's an extraordinarily expensive way for you. You could borrow money. With your means, you could be borrowing money at 6% to finance a home or finance that third car or that vacation house. You need to borrow some money because your equity is expensive to use for this when you could go out and borrow 6% money and save. So we try to get people, you know, to say, look, don't always think that debt is evil, because sometimes debt is actually borrowing some more money would actually make you have a lower overall cost of all the money that you use and you need. Now, I don't know where that is with you folks or even with me, but we know with wealthier people, we run into a lot. Well, I want to finance this with all the money in my pocket and my bank accounts. Don't do that for God's sake, okay? It's sort of like when you get these student loans at the end of this thing. Some people say, well, first thing I'm going to do is I'm just going to pay those off as fast as I can. Every paycheck, I'm going to beat the hell out of that thing. Actually, that's not such a good idea sometimes. Because if your equity, you can do more with your equity than the cost of that student loan's interest, you shouldn't be overpaying on the loan. Because if the loan's 7%, but you can be investing your money at 10%, 12% in the stock market, what the hell are you doing paying off two payments at a time? Unless you just feel like doing it, you're actually using expensive equity money to pay off cheap debt, just to re-leverage yourself off. Follow the idea here? It's kind of an interesting thing that debt is kind of like that evil, but sometimes it's the best way to finance something. Okay, here we go. And this is kind of more like a lecture, and the one next time is we're just going to be working all together here. So actually, when I talk about debt, like this case of D, realistically with a corporation, you're actually going to have a couple of tiers of debt. A case of D1 and a case of D2, at a minimum. I mean, I've seen tiers 3, 4, and 5 tiers of debt. But in this class, just 2 tiers. If they borrow up to $1 million, it will cost them 8%. If they borrow between $1 and $3 million, it will cost them 12% for that marginal cost. So in reality, there isn't a case of D. There are 2 case of Ds. The cheaper debt, and then a more expensive debt. So in order to get the first component cost of capital, this is the first formula you really have to put a box around or maybe put your chewing gum on or sneeze on it. After-tax cost, debt one, is 1 minus the company's tax rate times case of D1. So if I give you the first tier of debt, 8%, you would times that by 1 minus the company's tax rate to get case of AT1. That's your first component cost of capital. And then the next thing you would do is get case the after-tax cost of the second tier of debt, which would be 1 minus the tax rate times case of D2. Not hard, just don't forget to do it, for God's sake. Okay? So there is your component cost of capital called debt. These two formulas you will use on the worksheet, probably be the first thing you do, is get these two costs of debt. And also on the exam, you'll have a problem just like it, well, different numbers. So you just hammer these two little buggers out first. Now let's go and do equity. Now, I'm going to avoid preferred stock, okay? Because preferred stock, I'll give you the formula for it, but you won't have a problem that has preferred in it. Here's how we figure out the cost of equity. Remember that formula for the price? This is for preferred equity, okay? This is preferred equity. The price of a share of preferred stock is the dividend divided by the discount rate. You remember that perpetuity formula for a dividend, for a share of preferred stock? You turn that around and you find out that the cost of preferred stock, the component cost of preferred equity, is nothing but the dividend that's paid on a share of preferred divided by the price of the preferred. That's all it is. Very simple formula. We won't do any preferred because a lot of companies do avoid it. Or they do something weird now. Something, I don't know if I had said this, there's a new twist on preferred. Preferred, basically, once you have issued it as a corporation, you're stuck with a dividend for eternity, and you have to pay it. There are companies now that are issuing a preferred that actually, after a certain number of years, the company can either has this option to either buy it back or turn it into common stock. Makes it a little riskier, and it's kind of some investors don't like this because they want the fixed income nature of a preferred share. But companies feel a little more comfortable with not having this preferred stock outstanding for eternity that they have to pay a dividend on every year forever. So there is that twist on it. But even at that, companies really, you see some companies issuing preferred, but you don't see a lot of it. At least not for purposes of looking at companies that we do in a class like this. So you can kind of put that one on the side. Okay, let's not worry about that one. Now comes the cost of equity. Cost of equity. Okay, start with the formula that I've given you before the exam. The price of a share of common stock, P sub S, is the dividend 1 period out over the discount rate on stock minus the growth rate. And remember that you always have to, if I give you the current dividend, you have to grow it 1 period. Don't ever forget to do that, for God's sake. I'll give you a current dividend. Okay, now we're going to turn that little puppy around here. And we're going to say, okay, if I want to find what the cost of the stock was, the component discount rate for stock, then I would have to rearrange the formula so that in case of S, the cost of internally generated equity is going to equal that over there and that over there, the dividend 1 period out divided by the price per share right now plus the growth rate of the dividend. That is the cost of internally generated equity. The cost of the money that the company generates, it is a cost. It's actually an opportunity cost. That residual net income, well, net income in accounting terms, that residual cash flow, it's actually a cost to the company. Now, wait a minute. I thought that doesn't make sense. Yeah, because you see, once they have made that money, can do one of two things with it. They can either use it or they can not use it. But either way, it costs them to have it. Oh, your company just pulled in $10 million in net income. Okay, what are you going to do with it? Well, we're just going to sit on it. In other words, you're not going to reinvest it in the company. So you've got an opportunity cost. What if you reinvest it in the company? Well, it's a cost again because you could have used that money to buy another company. You see, every time you got net income, it turns into a cost for you right away. Because whatever you do with it, there's something else you could have done with it. If you take that money and you give it to the investors as dividends, stockholders, you've lost the cost of you right there. If you reinvest it in your corporation, you have lost it as an investment for another corporation. So it turns out that even what you make in accounting, profit is great, but in finance, it's just another cost to you. That's the cost of stock that is already outstanding. Now, the twist. The cost if you issue new stock, externally generated equity, it's actually pretty easy. Because basically, when you sell stock, you don't get the price per share. You get the price per share times one minus the flotation cost that the brokers hit you with, plus G. Back in my time when we made rain, we could actually, some companies, they had stock that was like $8 a share. We tell them, we can sell stock for you, but you're going to have to give us 25% of whatever we make. So they didn't get $8 a share, they got $6 a share. Percentage, they've cracked down on that now. But those percentages can still be staggering. A typical stock offering, the company doesn't get the price of the stock. The company might get 1 minus 8% of the price. Or 1 minus 8%. All the tricks and fees and accounting and lawyers and all that, it really can be, honestly, up to 12%. It can be seriously painful. So that's why cost of new stock is actually higher than the cost of internally generated equity. Because your opportunity cost isn't piece of S, it is worse. See the formula up here? That's technically the price of, that's the cost of internally generated preferred stock. There would be actually an externally generated preferred stock cost as well. The price of a preferred share times 1 minus F. Actually, that cost is so low, investment banks have very low fees on this right here. Very low fees. So technically, yeah, there's internally generated, externally generated preferred stock. But the float is actually really small. In some cases, it's virtually non-existent on preferred issues. That's something that gives some companies an incentive to issue preferred stock because of that cheap float. Up here, they're actually on borrowing. There can be a float on the debt that you borrow, on money you borrow. It's so minimal, it's hardly anyone ever talks about it, so we just don't even go there. F is the flotation cost. Think about it this way. And I'll give you an actual real example from when I was doing this. We had gone down to this place. It was one of those creepy places. It was in the back of the airport in Atlanta back at that time. It was in these out lots. There were these trailers back there, and airplane hulls and all that back there. And I was told by the money people who were taking me with them to work out a deal that the guy who was we were meeting with needed It was like $50 million. It was a pretty serious deal. But he was a genius in the airline industry. And he had made arrangements to get an unbelievable price on what was basically a fleet of jets that he wanted to turn into transports for packages. He had done all of this FAA work to get this company going. And it was just like, he's got it all ready. He's got the deal ready to go to turn what, it basically, it would have been like a FedEx or something like that. He was even working on a deal with the post office to fly their international mail on these. And we went in there and we just talked the deal. He was a very odd man. He was gray beard. He had this huge cigar and his eyes were like this almost glass blue. And he sat back, gray beard, and all this. And he talked to us for a while. He looked at me and said, he and I shared some knowledge of, I knew something about airplanes. So he said, you have the vision. I want to work with all of you. I need $50 million. And so we said, okay, we're going to raise $75 million for you. You're going to be on the hook for $75 million. We'll sell the stock. We know where to do it. We didn't. That much. Jeez. But he said, well, I don't understand. I need $50 million. That's right, because we're going to have $25 million when this is over. It was our grand slam. Of course, it didn't work out. There was a reason. I'll explain that in a minute why it didn't work out. That was our grand slam we were going to do. There's a float. $25 million on $50 million. So that gives you an idea. That's what a float is. Now, the same thing happens in the world now with big, reputable companies. Facebook went public. Those investment bankers, for every dollar of stock they sold, that syndicate kept a lot of that money. So basically, Facebook is on the hook for $10 a share stock when it got maybe $8.75, $9 out of every $10. So that's what that float represents, that bleed that happens right at the beginning of the sale, off the get-go. You don't have as much money when that deal is over as you might have thought. Wow, our stock is $50 a share. Isn't that wonderful? Well, you didn't get $50 a share. You got $42 a share. So sorry about your luck. The brokerage chain syndicate got the rest. By the way, the Grand Slam deal we were doing fell through because the guy, it turned out that he had been a runner who was flying marijuana in from the islands for the CIA, landing it in Louisiana on the coast, and then doing the deal to swap it for money and trade that money to an Middle Eastern government, which would then provide the money that flowed back through arms sales to rebels in Central America, complements of the CIA. Unfortunately, on one of his landings in Louisiana, he ran into the local sheriffs, and they busted him. And he said, well, I'm doing this for the government. They said, what? No, you're not. And, of course, the government said, no, you're not. So he did 5 years in prison for transport. And so the FAA said, we're not going to let you start an airline because you're a criminal. So that was how that deal went, fell apart. But anyway, that's life. Now, here we go. When they told me what was happening, I thought, this is like something out of a story. And then they showed me the newspaper clippings. Yeah, he was busted. He was nailed. He landed. This local hillbilly sheriff saw a DC fly in land full of bales. Busted him, and of course he was saying, well, I work for the government. Of course, the government said, no, you don't. That's what, really? We don't do that kind of stuff. And so all that paperwork, what was tragedy was he had completely created an airline, and it would have been a phenomenal thing. He died penniless, but he still had the vision. He just didn't know where to land his damn airplane. I can bring in a couple of fellows I work with who will swear that this story is actually true. But anyway, that was our grand slam. And of course, it was way out of our league anyway, raising that much money. But that was, you know, it was just a great deal, but we didn't get it. Here's the thing, though. You see, find someone who looks desperate for money. Yeah. Okay. You need a dollar. Okay. You got a project and it's going to cost a dollar. Okay, and I'm the finance treasury person. So you've got your projects lined up for next year. All of your different projects. Okay, so, and how much did you say they'll run? $1, sir. Okay. And I say, okay, here you go. Ah, ah, dad! New. Put your hand out. No. Because you see, we have an optimal capital structure. I can't just give you a dollar. My capital structure says 40% debt, 60% equity. So what I've got to do is, in order for you to start getting the money, I have to give you 40 cents that I borrow and 60 cents that I earned internally. Oh, you mean that's how it works? Yeah, that's exactly how it works. It sounds like that couldn't possibly be. Yeah, that's how it works in corporate finance. We don't just give you a dollar. Every dollar we give, we have to make sure how much of it came from one source and how much of it came from another source so that we stay on our optimal capital structure. If I just say, well, this is out of the sales drawer, a dollar, I've blown my optimal capital structure because I'm giving you all expensive equity money. Whereas, wait a minute, whereas, I am not doing good. Let me tell you, there is something wrong down in, okay. Okay, but, okay, well, I'll borrow all the money to give you. Here, you're damn, no, because actually, that wouldn't be a good idea either because I'm blowing through my first tier of debt capital right away. If I borrow so much, the bank is going to start charging me more interest. So every time I give you money, I have to give you the balance of debt and equity for everything that you borrow from me. So you've gone through your first dollar, and you say, I've got more projects. And I say, okay, that's fine. Let's talk here. We're going to, you want another dollar? Okay, I have to go and use some that's debt and some that's equity. Now, I'm going to go for the debt first because it's the cheaper. But eventually, I will blow the first tier of debt, and then I'll be paying more for that. So then I'll be on the second cost because I'll be paying D2, case of D2 AT, and equity. But still, that's how I do it. And then, eventually, I'll go through all of the money that I have earned in the company that's internally generated equity. Then I sell stock to get you more money. So then in the final rung, I'm going to have D2 money mixing with new equity money to give you. So literally, as I ramp up project to project to project, my cost of capital ramps up. D1, old equity. D2, old equity. D2, new equity. Let me show it to you graphically. If you understood what I said there, you are either very good and you should be in finance, or you're on meth. Okay?
And what's wrong with being tweaked in this class, teacher?
Okay. Look. Oh, ow, God. Look. Let me show you. Because essentially, your money, essentially, the first level of money that you have, whatever your capital structure is, maybe it's 60% debt, 40% equity. 40% equity. Okay. So on the first rung, when you borrow money from me for your projects, you're going to be using cheap debt and your cheap internally generated equity. That is really sucky looking, isn't it? I wouldn't even want that coming out of my nose. Here. say this company's optimal capital structure is 60% debt, 40% equity. So on the first rung, what I'll do for my money, for the first money that I need for projects, I will use 60% that will cost me and if you order before midnight. No, okay. KATD1, cheap debt and cheap equity. Your cheaper equity. Okay, as I ramp up further using money for projects, eventually I'll hit my limit and the bank's going to say, no, now we've got to charge you more. Okay, as long as the projects are worth it, and that's what we do on Tuesday, I will then be spending KATD2 and K sub S. I'll be taking, first of all, I'll be borrowing cheap money and taking money out of the cash drawer to finance you. And then once I've hit my limit with the bank on the cheap money, then I'll be taking on the more expensive debt and taking money out of the cash drawer. But eventually what's going to happen is I'm going to run out of money in the cash drawer, so I'll be borrowing expensive money and I'll have to issue new stock to pay for any last projects. That's how it works with companies. And essentially, the way we do project evaluation, realistically, we just keep taking on projects as long as their expected return is lower than the weighted average cost of capital here, the WACC. So all I'm doing when I look at projects, you keep coming back to me with new projects, and I'll say, okay, how much is it going to cost me the last dollar I give you for this project? As long as your project return is better than what it's going to cost me to finance it, it could be down here with this cost, here with this cost, or here with this cost. As long as... Oh, man. You know... That's the last time I eat sour cream and cheddar chips before class. Mmm. Where the hell was I? Okay. As long as I can just, get decent, just any kind of a gap at all. If you give me a project that's going to return me 12.2%, and the weighted average cost of capital of that project's going to be 12.1%, I'll still go with it. But the minute you say that there's a project where the last dollar I borrow, even the last dollar, is above the cost, is above what I get from it, you're done. So let me show you a little picture, a little window on what happens the next time. Here was a project. Its ROI was, let's say, 15%. That's your first project. The cost of that money was on tier one. Okay? Your second project, after you spend money on that one, this second project, its cost of its return is better than this tier of money that I'm borrowing on. But then this very last project starts here, and the cost jumps $5 from the end of it up to here. So you've jumped like this from this cheap to this more expensive to this more expensive. Your projects in order from the best down, one of them just finishes below the weighted average cost of capital. You don't accept that project. You don't even start it because it will end being more expensive than the money I used to pay for it. Even if $1, I need just $1 left, man. The rest of the project was way above the cost of the money for it. $1. Why are you doing this? Because that's how we do it. Even if $1 has to be brought in more expensive than the project's return, you're done. You say, nope, the whole project is rejected. Even if it's just the last couple of bucks. You say, well, why would that be? All that project? Here's why. You're dying of thirst. You want a glass of water. I have this beautiful, beautiful crystalline glass of water. And it has a tiny turd at the bottom. It's the tiniest turd. I mean, it was from a micro mouse. The rest of that, look at all that water. Here's your damn water, drink. You going to?
Yeah.
Turd floating. Little curls of brown. You going to drink that? You would. I should have asked a normal human being. Woman, would you? Hell no. You see, that's the thing, though. The whole thing was great except for that one last drop. Smells like mouse ass. Okay? That's the problem. It takes only $1 that's above that costs more than the return project done. That's all I have for you. Go home.